Good afternoon, Dr. Michael Van Straten. How are you?
I'm fighting fit, thank you very much.
That's
Dave, how are
great
you?
Great to hear. And how's the good lady?
The good lady is very well, recovered brilliantly from her fractured hip when she had a fall a couple of months
ago.
Yes. Well, for 6 months now, 5 months. But amazing. You know, we're seeing all this awful news about terrible delays and hours of waiting at A&E in the UK and months and years of waiting for operations. Well, the treatment here in France has just been phenomenal, you know.
Yeah.
She was in hospital, took her by ambulance the same day. The next morning, she was operated on for her hip replacement. And the day after that, they operated on her wrist because the week earlier she'd fallen and broken her wrist.
Wow.
But then,
she's not
doing
very well, is she then, Michael?
Well, no, absolutely. It's all this Christmas shopping.
If I was you, I think I would lock her in for the winter.
with a large ball and chain, quite right. But, you know, the amazing thing, and I think we've talked about this before, the aftercare is so important, virtually non-existent in the UK. Here, she had an amazing 6-7 weeks in a residential rehab home with daily massage, daily physio, exercise, everything provided, all for nothing, provided by the health service.
Wow, it's great, isn't it? And I can relate fully to that because we had some people in our church in their 80s, actually, and the woman fell over and broke her hip. And literally, that was a Sunday. Monday night, the hip operation had been completed. So it's great to hear. It's not always, you do hear a few stories, not always, depending, I think, sometimes on what goes wrong and the issue, but I think they're maybe a little bit understaffed in Spain, as maybe they are in France as well. But it's a breath of fresh air, isn't it, Michael?
It really is. And when you hear these stories, we spoke to so many English friends who live out here. Their father, who was at 90 plus, fell and broke his hip. It was 4 days before he got the operation.
Wow, yeah.
I think they were just hoping he would die before they had to do it. It would save them money.
And I've got friends who are waiting for a shoulder operation in the UK. He's been waiting nearly a year and a half, all said and done.
Normal. Horrendous. But there we are.
Right then, let's move on to, let's cheer ourselves up with the possibility of getting diabetes this Christmas if we drink too much coffee in Starbucks and so on. Other coffee shops are available, of course.
If somebody was sat opposite you in a cafe and they had a cup of tea and they put in a spoonful or two, you know, okay. Mm. If they put 3 spoons of sugar in their cup of tea, you'd look a bit surprised.
Yeah.
Well, I got news for you. If you go down to your favourite coffee shop during this Christmas festive period, they have got these special festive drinks on their menus.
Spiced lattes and so on.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And some of them have got more than 15 teaspoons of sugar in.
Oh, don't tell me that.
I mean, you go to Cafe Nero and have one of their winter spice hot chocolates. It's got 61.9 grams of sugar.
Wow.
That's 15 and a half teaspoonfuls.
Oh.
In a
Why?
Cup.
Why? Well, the thing is, I mean, I stopped having sugar in my tea and coffee about 10 years ago now. And when I have, if I accidentally drink my wife's and it's got a couple of spoons of sugar in it, which she has, she's starting to, she's pulling back. I don't taste the coffee, I just taste the sugar.
I know. Well, you know, nearly as bad. You want coffee, go to Starbucks.
Yeah.
They've got a pumpkin spiced cafe latte on their festive menu, right?
Yeah.
And that has got 51 and a half grams of sugar. That's 12 and a half teaspoons.
Wow. It's just unbelievable. But, Michael, I don't quite understand why. Because you could put a cup, okay, if you're going to, even 2 teaspoons of sugar, you're probably not going to be drinking it all the time. But if it was just a couple of teaspoons of sugar, surely it's still some good taste to it. Why that amount? I mean, surely. It doesn't need to be that much.
No, of course, there's absolutely no, there is no need, but there is every reason not to. I mean, we know now so much information about the fact that sugar is probably more dangerous for your overall health than fat. That you're much more likely to die of heart disease caused by your diabetes than you from taking too much sugar, then you are likely to get having a bit of extra cheese or, yeah, or having real butter or full fat milk in your coffee. And why? The manufacturers know all this. They know all the campaigns. They know all the government health warnings. They hear the doctors endlessly talking on the media, in the newspapers, on the wireless, yeah, on the telly, about the risk, especially for youngsters, where we're seeing this explosion of type 2 diabetes in young people. And they serve up a drink which has got, you know, 15 or 12 or 10 teaspoons of sugar in one mug of drink. I mean, I think it's obscene. I mean, somebody should do, they should be prosecuted. There should be some law, yeah, against excessive offerings of sugar. Or they should be forced to put a huge, great poster on the wall, you know, sort of 10 by 8 feet large, you know, wall, you know, newspaper page size posters on their walls showing exactly how much sugar there is.
What I'd like to know is what the difference in taste would be between two sugars in a coffee that size and 15. I don't think, surely, that if you got two sugars in a coffee that size, it's still going to be sweet. It's still going to taste, yeah, sweet. My view on the Christmas market, I don't know what your views are on this, but I always think, why have that 15 in the coffee? It's kind of like, it's empty calories for me. I'd much rather have a nice piece of cake and use my calories wisely on, or use my sugar intake wisely on something I'm going to enjoy more. Does that make so, yeah, that sense?
Well, exactly. I mean, you get to a point of saturation where you couldn't tell the difference in a drink if it had 15 spoons of sugar or if it had 5 spoons, yeah, of sugar. Yeah. You probably couldn't tell the difference between 3 and 5 spoons.
Yeah.
Because they would both taste incredibly sweet. So why do they put this much sugar in? I would love to hear from some of, yeah, their technical directors of food development at these stores. I mean, I wonder if they'd ever gone round and asked their clients, their customers, what they think. If they asked them 100 customers in a coffee shop during one day, if they would like a drink, especially for their kids, which had got 15 spoons of sugar in it, how many would say yes, please?
Well, it's definitely a warning, Michael, isn't it? And I know a lot of people like these coffees, so we don't want to be a killjoy, but it's worth bearing that in mind, isn't it? And for me, I always say, you know, I'm going to save my sugar intake for the stuff that I really am going to enjoy, like a bit of Christmas pudding and brandy sauce or something.
Well, look, there's a difference between being a killjoy and being sensible, yeah, using common sense. And this is not common sense, Dave. This is actual health madness.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not saying that just because I'm a naturopath and I prefer people to have more natural sort of foodstuffs and all that sort of story. It's because it's a question of sane healthcare, and they just do not take anything remotely sane about their healthcare.
And a lot of people probably think, okay, it's a nice drink, it's a bit sweet, but they're probably not ever going to consider the fact that it's got that amount of sugar in it. So,
well, of course they're not. They're never going to think about it. And when they taste it, it will taste very sweet, but they wouldn't imagine how much sugar there was in it.
Yeah.
And if anybody's listening and is taking their kids out to a coffee shop somewhere at Christmas, just take the sugar shaker and put 15 grams onto a plate and see what a big pile, yeah, that is, and then ask them if they'd like to eat it. You know, I mean, it's a nightmare.
That'll sort them out.
I think it's very irresponsible myself.
Now, as a parent, sometimes I'm struggling to get my little boy to eat broccoli, you know, and carrots as they are, but we do sometimes be a little bit devious, I'm sure some parents do, sneak it into a nice soup. And he'll lap it up, and he doesn't realise he's taking in all this great veg. But apparently soup has got anti-malarial properties anyway, so I love a good soup every now and then, Michael.
This is just a famous, famous, famous story, totally updated. You know, my mother came from a long, long line of Middle European, Eastern European Jewish family cooks.
Yeah.
Right? And my mother used to make chicken soup every week,
yeah,
that you could almost stand a spoon up in it. It was full of, it was chicken, you know, and all sorts of vegetables, and just cooked and cooked and cooked, yeah, for hours on end.
Yeah.
And, you know, the family joke was that it was Jewish penicillin. It would cure anything. You've got a cold, have a bowl of chicken soup, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And
this sort of apocryphal story has been around for years, and there's been quite a lot of research done into chicken soup, and they found that because it's made by boiling the whole chicken with its bones for several hours, that extracts certain substances from the bones which have antibacterial activity.
Yeah.
Now, there's a new story, and this was just, it blew me away. This was in one of the British Medical Journal special journals called the, horrible name, the Archives of Diseases in Childhood. but it's a very important journal. And some very bright researchers had seen a lot of these stories about soups and things being healthy. And these particular researchers were very involved in malaria prevention.
Right.
And there were, again, there were these apocryphal stories from various parts of the world that soups could help to prevent malaria. So what they did, their researchers went to one school, like just one single school in London.
Yeah.
Right? They were all lived in the same area of eastern London. And they asked all the kids there to bring a sample of their parents' homemade soup, traditional,
yeah,
old recipe soups. And they collected about 60 of these, and some of them had too much oil in them, and some of them were too thick, so they couldn't filter them. And in the end, they tested over 50 of these soups. See?
Yeah.
And they were testing them against a particular, very nicely, the worst, the most dangerous of all the malarial parasites. And what did they find? Surprise, surprise. A number of these soups produce substances which actually killed off the malarial parasites or prevented them from developing. And they tested them against the standard powerful anti-malarial drug, which, interestingly enough, the most modern of them, is made from an ancient plant called the Artemisia, based on a Chinese remedy,
yeah,
which has been used in Chinese medicine for years to treat infections. And it's now found that this particular Artemisia derivative is one of the most potent anti-malarials, and it's being used worldwide now.
Okay.
And they tested it against this particular extract of the Artemisia, and four of the soups were just as effective as this standard drug for the treatment of malaria, and several of the others were so effective that they would kill off or prevent the development of at least 50% of the bacteria.
Mm.
So the potential of this for finding out even more natural substances which were effective anti-malarials was just miraculous for them, because the real problem is that the malaria parasite is growing more and more resistant to the which is why the use of Artemisia extracts, yeah, has been such a great revolution in the treatment of malaria in modern days. And what they're looking for, obviously, is to try and find what it is in these soups that is producing this amazing effect. Of course, lots more work to be done.
Good old ingredients, I think.
But it's good, yeah, old. And these soups were, some of them were meat soups,
yeah,
and a lot of them were just straightforward vegetable soups made from a great mixture of vegetables.
So yeah, get it in. Good winter food. And just so much in there. And Michael, we've got maybe just a couple of minutes left on our final point here, which kind of links in anyway for the winter time. Self-help for winter ills from nature. Maybe give us one or two.
Well, this is one of the great sort of standards, you know, of natural medicine. And that is natural ways of treating all those winter ills like colds and bugs and coughs and all those sort of things. And, you know, some years ago, the British Cold Research Centre did a huge huge study. They've been researching for years for treatments for the common
sorry,
cold.
Michael, sorry, just to cut across you. We just had a listener WhatsApp in saying, is that a grey-leafed plant that you're talking about? Lost your train.
Artemisia?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a very traditional... Artemisia vulgaris is what's usually used in the UK. It's also, by the way, I think the herb that was originally used to make that wonderful French liquor, alcohol, which gave all the famous painters these wonderful hallucinations. And it was banned for years in France, but it's just been allowed to be sold again in France.
Okay. There we are.
Yeah.
Yes, it is the grey leaf plant. That's it. Okay.
Yeah.
I cut across you there, but back to the remedies then for winter.
Yeah. And there are so many things in nature which are so efficient. And the Common Cold Research Department found... Years ago, they published a big study and found that basically most of these things you buy over the counter, these cold cures and cough treatments, particularly for the common cold, are a waste of money. They don't work any better than traditional remedies like honey and lemon or eucalyptus for your cough and for your chest. I mean, for instance, if you've got a kiddie in your family who's got a nasty cough, right? If you get hold of some eucalyptus leaves, or you can buy eucalyptus oil from any essential oil shop or most pharmacies these days, and you put a few drops of that in a bowl, cover it with boiling water, and then...
sound like you need it yourself.
Yeah, quite right. And then put a big towel over your head, over the bowl, and just inhale the steam.
Yeah.
And within 10 minutes of doing that, The chest will be soothed, a lot of the mucus will run away from your nose. And if you do that a couple of times a day for 3 or 4 days, it will make a miraculous difference and cost you pennies.
So this eucalyptus oil, you can buy that in the herbalistas and so on, in the herbal shops.
Oh, yeah, buy that in any herbalista. Yeah. But often you can buy it these days in cooking shops because they use these essential oil extracts in cooking.
Eucalyptus oil, brilliant.
And another one, which is so effective... really effective, is to use one of the simple herbs like thyme.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure where you are in Spain, most people have got thyme growing in their gardens.
I've got a lot of thyme on my hands, Michael. Carry on.
but if you haven't got it growing, you can buy dried thyme in any food shop. Or again, you can buy the essential oil of thyme. Now, if you remember when you were a kid going to the dentist, when you were asked to rinse your mouth after he'd been messing about in it with his drills and things, they had a sort of a glass of pink stuff sitting on the stand beside the dentist's chair.
Yes.
And that pink stuff was a chemical called thymol, an antiseptic, which is an extract of thyme.
Wow. Okay.
And thyme is a powerful antiseptic.
Yeah.
So if you've got just a rotten bit of a cold and a bit feeling a bit under the weather with a bit of a respiratory infection and a typical winter infection, if you put a handful of leaves or a few drops of oil or a teaspoonful of dried thyme into a mug, pour boiling water over it, cover it with a saucer, and let it stand for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then take the top off. When it's cool enough, just sip it. Drink it, sip at a time, till it's all gone. And again, you'd have a glass of that twice, three times a day. It will really help to knock on the head any ordinary cold infection, minor winter ailments. It's a powerful antiseptic. It has no nasty side effects. It won't upset your what's now called the biome, your natural biome. That's the natural bacteria that live in your gut, which are so important for your overall natural resistance. You take antibiotics, it kills the good bugs and the bad bugs.
Yes, yes.
So it takes sometimes months or years to recover. Thyme has no side effects. It tastes good. It smells lovely. And it's a miracle. It really, really works. And it costs pennies.
I think from what you're saying, Mark, it's just a good idea, isn't it? Just have this stuff in the kitchen anyway, ready to go.
It is.
Yeah. Go and get some. Even if you've not got a cold, go and get it ready, because you will have a cold at some point.
Well, always. And if you have a look on my website, I'm sure, I can't remember exactly where it is on there, but I am sure that if you go to the website and put medicinal herbs into the search engine,
yeah,
you'll find a whole load of information about all the different herbs that you can grow in your garden or get in the grocer's shop, with what they're good for, how to use them, how to make them into teas or infusions, or how to make them into oils, all sorts of information. And you can do these things for pennies, for a great jug full of stuff, which will cost you pounds if you go to the chemist and buy a ready-made, and according to the, you know, the Common Cold Research Institute, don't do any good. They're no, not as good for you as if you've got a rotten cold, you go to bed and you have a hot toddy with boiling hot water, a juice of a whole lemon, a stick of cinnamon, a couple of cloves, and a tiny, tiny dash of alcohol. Not for the kids, of course, but literally, I mean, like a half a pub measure, that's virtually, you know, a tablespoonful of brandy or whiskey or whatever your tipple is you've got in the house. And then just slowly, slowly sip it gently, and you do that at night time. It helps to dilate all the bronchial tubes, it makes you sweat a bit, and it really does help to fight off these minor infections.
A wee dram. Right, well, anyway, now, Dr. Michael Van Stratton, there's always fascinating stuff. We've had Kevin in Mallorca says, there's nothing wrong, you can't beat a good beef stew. I said, good on you, Kevin. Yeah, nice beef stew with plenty of veg and gravy. Right.
I'll be round tomorrow.
Michael, if anybody wants to find you online, how can they do that?
Oh, just go to your search engine and just put in Michael Van Stratton, all one word, michaelvanstratton.com.
Lovely.
And you'll find all the information, all the books and information and recipes and dozens of fact sheets and anything you want. You'll probably find mostly on the website, and it's all for nothing.
Lovely. Michael, as always, we'll speak again soon. Take care and keep well.
Lovely to talk to you, Dave.
Cheers, Michael. Bye-bye.